Welcome to the More Perfect Union, a podcast about the joy we get from American politics. I'm Alan, a libertarian from Saginaw, Michigan.
I'm Jonah, an independent from Maryland.
I'm DJ, self-confessed Republican from Suffolk, Virginia.
And I'm Kevin, a moderate Democrat from Los Angeles.
So you can find more about us at moreperfectunionpodcast.com. You can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/moreperfectunionpodcast. And since you're probably listening to this on your iThing, whether that's an iPad or an iPhone or even a Mac computer, go to iTunes, rate and review us. Give us 5 stars. Tell the world that we're the best thing that's ever happened to you. Now, let's talk about politics, shall we? A couple things happened last week. DJ, I understand that about 14 of your best friends showed up on stage in Las Vegas or something.
It was 13 and Donald Trump, but yes, the Republican debates had another round this week. And what was interesting for a lot of folks within the party and outside the party was essentially how Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, who are at this point the two closest to Donald Trump in the polls, decided to ignore Donald Trump and go after each other. They argued about national security. They argued about intelligence and counterintelligence, and they argued about immigration. And that's probably the one that had the biggest impact within the party, as Marco Rubio essentially said, you know, when Ted Cruz talks about how firm he is against amnesty and against illegal immigration and everything else, yeah, well, he's full of crap because he actually tried to push through legalization back in 2013. And Cruz said, no, I didn't. That was smooth legislative tactics to show that your bill was a failure and blah, blah. By the time they went back and forth, the question essentially was whether Ted Cruz is really a principled guy or whether he's just another ambitious politico seeking higher office.
What I heard was, no, I didn't. Yes, you did. No, I didn't. Yes, you did. That was it. That's all I heard. The other thing is, I don't know who's right either.
They're both right. But here's the thing. Cruz and DJ knows this. Cruz did something during the immigration debate that was too cute by half. He tried to stop the Gang of Eight by introducing a bill that would kind of push their full amnesty bill off rail. He didn't want his thing to actually work. He just wanted to use it as a wedge. He did. But it just like when John Kerry said, I voted against the bill before I voted for it, or vice versa, whatever he said. This is that same thing. He was using legislative hocus pocus to try to accomplish something. But you can't easily explain that in a political campaign. Is that right, DJ? Do you think that's pretty much
it? That is correct. But I think also Cruz took it a step further in 2013 when he said, I want this amendment to pass, I want this bill to pass. And he actually said that on the Senate floor. He said it in interviews at the time.
I saw that on the news. He did say that.
Mm-hmm. He gave the impression he was trying to find what he considered a middle way. He is pretending that you're right, that he was just being clever, but you're right, because of the actual statements out there, he has essentially been too clever by half. It doesn't seem to have hurt him as much as I thought it would hurt him, but it did. I think it did leave something of a mark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I'm looking at the sort of the fallout from this now, because I guess before we talk about the fallout, the one thing I noticed from this, so Wolf Blitzer was the moderator, and there was a lot of sort of complaining afterwards that it was Cruz and Rubio were going at each other, and then Jeb Bush and Donald Trump sort of had their moments of conflict, and all that was true, but it was because of the way Wolf Blitzer asked his questions. So, like, the complaint there was, Jeb Bush, you don't like Donald Trump. Why not? Well, Donald Trump's an idiot. And then they argue for a little while. Marco Rubio, you have a problem with Ted Cruz. Why don't you talk about it? So, like, the headlines sort of coming out of the debate to me were Cruz and Rubio fight. Jeb Bush doesn't like Donald Trump even louder. But it was framed in such a way for them to start these, you know, turn to your right and argue with that person.
It was sort of WWE-esque, I thought.
Yeah, this was the same tact that what's his name? Jake Tapper used when he moderated, and it's the same network. So I think that CNN's approach is very much, let's get them to fight. Whereas... Yeah. Go ahead.
But I will say this, though. When Tapper tried it, all the campaigns beat the heck out of him. Some of the candidates actually hit him on stage during the debate.
He was this time. Cruz made some points on that one, I remember.
Right. This time, none of the candidates complained because that's what they wanted to do.
Yeah, I didn't think it was as egregious this time either.
They wanted to do separation. Right, but Wolf took them where they wanted to go this time. So they didn't really complain.
I thought Hugh Hewitt was really good, too.
I think Jonah's right. Wolf may have tried to stir the pot, but in this case, the pot wanted to be stirred, so it let itself be stirred.
Maybe. I thought Hugh Hewitt was relatively masterful, too, actually. He's usually pretty good at this stuff. And he flat said, no, this was not CNN. This was me that put this question out there. It was interesting.
Yeah, I like that. I don't know. I feel like he's... On the two debates that he's been on, he's been pretty, you know, I mean, this is his party. He's very conservative. He's very open about that. That's why he's there. And he's just asking questions that he really wants answers to. So,
yep, I agree.
I mean, he is authentically himself, whether you like that or not.
I give CNN credit for including him, to tell you the truth, because he's pretty right wing for their demo. But I thought he was pretty good.
And he got the soundbite of the night when he asked Donald Trump if he would, commit to the Republican Party. And Trump said, you know, now that I think about it, yeah, I think Hewitt was stumped. He didn't expect that answer.
Yeah.
I don't think any of us did.
Yeah.
Do we believe him? Do we believe Trump? Is this issue over?
I doubt it.
And this is funny. I'm the guy who, for the last 5 weeks, have been telling you guys that Trump is going to run independent. But after that, and then after seeing him after the debate confirming it, I'm now thinking maybe he won't. I don't know. I hope he does, but I don't know.
Yeah. And I mean, he keeps going. The polls keep going in his direction, you know. I mean, what we've seen for sure is Ben Carson is sinking. Like, it looks like there's no recovery for him. Mm-hmm. But I guess indeed the speculation is true. Like Carson and Trump were splitting that vote because most of it's gone to Trump and he's gone up like 10 points or something in the last month ish. When you aggregate all the polls, and Ted Cruz is going up too. So he's pulling some as well, but
actually I think Cruz is getting more of the Carson vote. I'm sorry to contradict you, but that's what I heard one of the analysts saying today.
So I'm just looking at the, our big site that we refer to all the time is Real Clear Politics. And when you look at the aggregate on there, it looks like there's a lot happening. But Trump went up like 10 points or so in the last month. Carson went down more than 10 points. And Cruz, I don't know. So whatever Cruz is pulling from, Trump is also going up. They're both going up.
So I would actually say you're both right. I would say you're both right. Jonah is right nationally in that Trump has been the beneficiary nationally. But Trump has not been the beneficiary in Iowa or New Hampshire. Carson's vote in those two states are going to other people, in large part Cruz. So the interesting thing we're going to have to see is what actually happens in Iowa and what actually happens in New Hampshire. And I think that, obviously it's a truism because we've said it all the time. But Iowa, New Hampshire will really shape what's going on. It's largely the fact that Trump, Cruz, and Rubio are going to come out of Iowa, New Hampshire, going into South Carolina, Nevada, and onward. The question really is anyone else going to? Can Christie make the breakthrough? Can Jeb Bush come back to make the breakthrough? Can John Kasich make the breakthrough? If they can't, then it's just the three of them. If one of them can, then they get into, for lack of a better term, the semifinals, going into South Carolina, Nevada, Florida, and so on.
It struck me as a couple things struck me in this GOP debate. First off, Trump does not know the issues at all. Trump, and yet it doesn't seem to affect him at all. But do you guys remember Hugh Hewitt's question on the nuclear triad?
Yeah,
yeah,
the triad.
Okay, let's be honest. He had no idea what he was talking about.
Of course, yeah,
absolutely.
In retrospect, I didn't know until I kind of looked into it a little bit. But I wasn't on the stage in a debate for president. He didn't have any idea what he was talking about, and it totally did not affect him at all. He blathered on for 3 minutes about nothing. He just didn't know. And then Rubio steps up and knocks it out of the park. He knew exactly what he was talking about. The whole thing's a bit of a farce.
But Trump's voters don't know what the nuclear triad is either.
Sure, exactly.
And I think in a lot of ways, probably with Trump basically expounding his ignorance, he probably, frankly, appealed to a lot of them and said, "Oh, good, I don't want to be careful." But
that's what he is on so many things. He just doesn't know. He doesn't have the depth of knowledge of the other candidates that are running. It's a joke. It really is.
I want to jump in for a second. In fairness to Trump voters, and I don't think that's ever been said actually in the English language, but in fairness to Trump voters, I trace this back to the 2000 election, because that's the first time that I recall, and it may have happened before. Maybe it happened when Ike was running against Adlai Stevenson, but clearly in 2000, there was this attitude in the electorate that the smarter guy was an egghead and that the dumber guy was a real person like us. Now, George W. Bush is not a dumb guy, and George W. Bush is 10 to 50 times more intelligent on politics and on international issues than Donald Trump. But, you know, that was the start of it, of this discounting of knowledge and education, this kind of turning it from a positive to a negative. And so this is not a new thing in American politics.
No, I agree with you. On the other hand, though, Cruz, everyone feels like Cruz is the smart guy in the room. And he would be someone who would split votes with Trump, though, don't you feel like? I mean, Cruz definitely he's a policy wonk, and he can talk the game. He and Rubio both are really
– Cruz and Rubio are really smart guys. You know, as a Democrat, I'm not a fan of either of them. Cruz is brilliant at what he does, and I imagine
really
that
fast on his feet too. His
IQ is probably, you know, very impressive, and you know, I've been watching Marco Rubio, as we all have, the last couple of months, and the last few weeks. Every time I see this guy getting interviewed, I'm convinced he would be the toughest candidate for Hillary or Bernie to go up against. I don't think he'd make a great president. I certainly don't agree with his views on most issues. But boy, he is sharp on his feet, and he can talk off the cuff on pretty much any
subject. I feel like he and Cruz sort of share that. But what's interesting to me that after watching, I didn't watch the whole debate, but I actually watched the Republican debate more of it. I watched probably better part of an hour of it. And it seemed like it was a three-person debate, maybe four if you throw Christie in there. But it seemed like it was all Trump, Rubio, and Cruz. I felt like I even put up on Facebook, I'm like, there's way too many candidates. Way too many candidates. It's getting stupid now. This is the fifth debate? Like, well, we've still got 14 candidates up there. This is the fifth debate. This is just getting stupid.
We did lose one this week.
Yeah, we did.
And
it's
a sad one, too. But Lindsey Graham bowed out, so there's room on that main stage.
Does that mean there's 13 now?
13 now.
13 now.
Yeah.
Well, it's a lucky 13. Number.
I feel like again, I'm not a Republican Party guy. I'm going to pull the lever for the Libertarian more than likely this time around. Just, you know, I'm happy to talk about either, but the bottom line is I probably am more Republican than Democrat, but I'm not really either. But 13 candidates, really? Come on,
it's crazy. And by the way, I'm going to just jump in and pat my own back, because I don't get enough positive reinforcement
Lindsay?
In my life. I called it weeks ago when it first came up, and what I said was, he will be out early because he cannot let himself get embarrassed in his home state.
Yeah, and that was
and
the
as
deadline,
we all found
wasn't
out
it?
today was the deadline to take his name off South Carolina, which, if I had heard that on the news, they didn't share that with us, I would have said this on last week's program, because I knew he was not going to be on that ballot.
Well, he would have been embarrassed, by the way. He probably wouldn't have even shown up.
Yeah.
So it was a smart move on his part, I think.
Yeah.
So he was the big advocate for boots on the ground military intervention right now.
Yep.
So there aren't there are a number of candidates that sort of agree theoretically, but his whole candidacy was about pushing that. Does this mean that you guys think do you think any other of these Republican candidates are going to double down on, you know what, we really do need 50,000 more troops on the ground?
I don't know about 50,000, but I do think that as this goes on, they're going to get more hawkish. Yes, I do think that it's going to go in that direction.
And I think it already has, to an extent it has. I think Rubio, it was one of the things Rubio tried to do in his discussion with Cruz, and that he was trying to essentially Cruz's attempt to sort of split the difference between the hawks in the party and the doves in the party, the Rand Paul supporters, is to say, well, I'll just hit ISIS from the air, and if I hit ISIS from the air, everything will be fine. And Rubio was actually put forth the notion that, yes, ground troops would be necessary. He didn't quite say American ground troops are necessary. I don't think anyone is going to go as far as Graham saying we need 50,000 troops in there or 100,000 or whatever it is. But someone will probably, they may even throw out a number like 5,000 or 10,000. But I think it's probably about the highest that any of the candidates are willing to go. My guess is Rubio would probably get there first and say we need some serious ground contingent. And then, you know, maybe Bush or Christie or Kasich will then follow him, and because, you know, they're waiting for someone to do it first. But I'm guessing it'll probably be Rubio who does. But no one's going to go up to the level that Lindsey Graham wanted.
Yeah. No. But, you know, I just laugh every time these gentlemen and lady open their mouths on the subject, because they throw out these ideas like, well, we need to have a coalition led by the Muslim countries. And that's what I do, as if, you know, the Obama White House has not considered that or is not trying to do that. Or they talk about, you know, increasing the bombing missions and that we don't have enough sorties, as if they're just laying back and going, well, let's just fly a few, you know, B-52s or whatever we use these days. Let's fly, you know, fly a few F-15 Tomcats over there and drop just a handful of bombs just to make a showing. It's so ludicrous that these people stand up there and make suggestions that either are unworkable, like carpet bombing in a targeted way, or just make no sense at all, like, you know, putting up, you know, a no-fly zone, and if Russia decides to fly there, to hell with them, we'll shoot them out of the sky. It's unbelievable that these people say things that make no sense or are already being done, and then turn around and criticize the president as if he's not as smart as them.
Well, frankly, if the president, I think what this is really stemming from is a lot of us, because this is something that is generally throughout the party, are of the opinion that the president, that at least until very recently, and some will insist not at all, the president really hasn't prioritized the fight against Daesh. It is something that is widespread throughout the party. It is something that we are, and it's not just something widespread at the party, it's something that we actually have heard from folks who are in the region. Turkey is not particularly happy with us. Granted, we shouldn't be particularly happy with Turkey. They have their own agenda.
If you don't mind, but I want to call you on this, DJ. Can you be more specific on how he hasn't prioritized it? Because I think that's just words. That's word salad. What do you mean he hasn't prioritized it? You don't think that he's dealing with this 50% of every day of his administration?
Honestly, the way he talks about it, no.
Wow. Okay.
No, I don't.
No, I think the news backs him a little bit on Kevin. I feel like
what isn't he doing that he could be doing? When you say Turkey isn't happy with him, it's because we're arming the Kurds, who are the best fighters we have on the ground.
But we have done little, if anything, to help anti-Daesh Sunnis in Iraq. We continue to give a fig leaf to the Iraqi government, which in its own way has really done nothing for the Sunnis in that region.
Exactly.
We have not the president. So he should be directly arming them. We should be directly arming them ourselves.
And every time Baghdad we gave them arms, they ended up in the hands of ISIS.
No, that's the arms drops over in Syria. I'm talking about the Sunnis in Ramadi. I'm talking about the Sunnis in Nineveh. I'm talking about the Sunnis on the Iraqi side of the border, the ones who are part of the Anbar Awakening, and who have been screaming for help for years, and who in fact got so upset at being ignored by this administration, they tried to get George W. Bush to lobby for them in Washington, because they remembered when he stuck his neck out for them in 2006 and 2007 during the surge. Those people have been ignored. When the president says, I show leadership against Russia and against Daesh by going to a climate change summit in Paris, it tells me that he does not get it. It tells me that he does not prioritize this. And it tells everybody who voted, everybody who voted against him, and even a number of people who voted for him, that his priorities are just out of whack and that he is out of touch. He has admitted he has admitted, Kevin, that he didn't understand how upset people were about Paris or San Bernardino because he doesn't watch cable TV news. I don't watch cable TV news either. I didn't need to know that to know how much people were affected by Paris and San Bernardino.
I think that you're taking his words out of context.
He's completely out of touch.
He's completely out of touch. Okay. I'd like to visit your universe sometime. I'm sure the weather's nice there.
I don't know. The weather is not bad this week. I don't know. I see between the two that this is why politics doesn't work.
I mean, he's completely out of touch. Oh my God. I just don't understand how you can say that.
I will acknowledge it completely was probably okay. I will acknowledge that was too much of an adjective.
But you're backing him full force, Kevin. You think he's right on the money.
I would say he's very much in touch.
Yes.
You think he's right on the money. The climate change summit was awesome, and the way he's handled San Bernardino, the way he's handled Paris, right on the money. Really good stuff.
I normally don't like people putting words in my mouth, but those words feel just fine.
Okay, I'm just checking. Just getting you down there. Yeah. So
want to say right on the money, that's a loaded, obviously that's a loaded phrase too. That works as well as completely out of touch.
So we will both acknowledge that the superlatives are superlative.
Right. But I would say that if you're asking my opinion, which is only worth whatever it's worth, I think that he is doing as good a job as any president could do given the circumstances and the climate, both militarily and politically in Europe. In the Middle East, that he inherited. I think this is what it is. There is no good answer. There simply isn't. And I think everything from Donald Trump to Lindsey Graham and everyone in between, it's all just noise. And frankly, probably true on the Democratic side too.
How about Chuck Hagel's interview today where he said basically when the president backed away from retaliating against Bashar Assad for his use of chemical weapons, he soured relations with just about every ally we had in the region.
He backed away because the Congress wouldn't approve it. He went to Congress for approval, and they said no.
At first he said he was going to go ahead and do it anyway.
Yeah, but before he ran, he said he wanted to be a different kind of president who didn't do the kinds of things that George Bush did. Okay,
he went to Congress, he gave them
the option, they said no, or basically they wouldn't vote on it, and he lived within the three branches of government, and you're hitting him for listening to Congress. Normally people say, oh, he takes executive action, he breaks the law, he hates the Constitution. Here, he was respecting Congress's, responsibility to wage war, or to vote to wage war, and which they would not do. And you guys could laugh at me. That's okay. But I'm just trying to counter the argument. And I get that. I'm not mad at you, DJ. I'm just trying to counter your argument.
Nobody's mad at each other, Kevin. Right. What I find interesting, though, is that what we are basically acknowledging here is that this is a president who believes that stopping the enforcement of our immigration laws is worth going around Congress, but stopping someone from unleashing chemical weapons against his own people is not something worth going around Congress. That shows a priority disconnect, in my opinion, and that shows a president that is not completely, but very out of touch.
Well, that's a nice equation, and I can follow the logic of it. I just think that there's hyperbole in the comparison. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, so I just wanted to say that, going back to the idea that, the speculation is he's spending about half his day, 50% of his time on this stuff. And I just have to say, I hope to God he's not. I hope he's spending much less than 50% of his time. Because
you don't think he's getting the results?
No, I don't care. So this might be the first time that I'm going to say that I agree with Rand Paul on something. But I definitely agree that we should not be the world's police force. And if we're talking about...
I think that was Bernie Sanders was saying that too.
He said it recently, yeah. but But we're still on the Republicans, so I'm going to talk about yeah, Rand Paul on this. So I'm going to, you know, I think that diplomacy is the United States' primary path here. And that can be what Hillary Clinton was talking about and, like, you know, the UN resolution. That can be helping to create alliances in the Middle East. Maybe it's somehow encouraging, like, you know, the African Union. Maybe it's somehow getting some kind of something going on. But the one area I disagreed with Lindsey Graham on was I didn't think we need 50,000 more troops. I don't think that we need, I don't think we should be doing that. And I think that this is such a, like, civil war to civil war and deposing dictators, and it's such a giant mess that I don't know what 50% of your time equals. I think when it comes to immigration and that when it comes to gun control and when it comes to, you know, jobs and the economy and all that, I want him to be spending more than 50% of his time dealing with domestic stuff.
Okay. And, well, first of all, obviously I was pulling 50% out of, you know, some orifice in my body. I was just trying to make a counter argument to again, a hyperbole that I think DJ would probably acknowledge now that the president was disengaged from this. So let's not get caught up in 50%, but I understand your point that you want him to be engaged in a lot of core issues that are important to the American people.
And I feel like that climate change summit, who knows what's going to come of it? But that was appropriate. It was appropriate for him to go where the world leaders were and talk about something that maybe, you know, we can't get traction on stuff like that in this country, but maybe he can help the rest of the world actually get stuff done, you know?
And by the way, you know, when he's at these conferences, you don't think that the Middle East comes up? You don't think that he takes advantage of a side moment with, you know, King Abdullah or, you know, or the president of France, who's, I'll admit, right off the top of my head, I'm not remembering his name.
But you don't think François Hollande.
You don't think that he takes, you know, a moment to touch in on other topics that are important to these things? I mean, we saw him sitting with Putin at a conference 3 weeks ago where they were clearly talking about the ISIS situation.
To make me feel better?
Yeah.
That he is basically working with the guy who, under the guise of fighting terrorism, is basically bombing the very few people in the country who like us.
Well,
that he's
pushing
to the wall to support the guy who, according to most German, as the German media has discovered, Der Spiegel, is basically working hand in glove with ISIS to carve the country in half to get rid of their mutual enemies, who are the very few, who are the Sunnis who are fighting for a secular democratic Syria.
Yes.
Why should sitting with Vladimir Putin be considered helpful? Putin isn't part of the solution. He's part of the problem.
I disagree, but that's okay. I mean, I don't pretend to be so nuanced in foreign, you know, policy. I'm just going to make a very coarse analogy, which is we worked with Stalin during World War II. Sometimes, you know, the enemy of your enemy is your friend.
And during the last Iraq war, there were a lot of countries that accused us of doing that same thing, you know? So, I mean, dividing the country and trying to get the resources.
Until 2007, we were.
Yeah,
I mean, what fixed the country wasn't the increased troops in the surge. It was the president of the United States saying to the Iraqi people, we're as upset about Iran as you are, and we're going to crack down on them as much as you want us to. That's what saved Iraq in 2007, 2008, not the additional troops, I'd say it.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's a mess, you know? Like, I don't know what everybody agrees on anymore, but I know that this is – we don't have enough information, first of all, like about this stuff. Like, I don't know.
Let me respond to that. And I'm sorry if I'm dominating the conversation, but obviously I'm very passionate about this. Here's what I think is happening. I think one thing that everyone in the civilized world agrees on is that to defeat ISIS, we're going to need some type of strong military counterpresence, and it should be Muslim or Middle Eastern led. It should be the Saudis, it should be the Kuwaitis, it should be Jordan, it should be the Turks, you know, you name it. But the
I'm
point
not part
is,
of that consensus.
Oh, okay. Well, let me finish my thought and then you can counter it, okay?
Go ahead.
Okay. If you buy into this and maybe not everybody does, but if you buy into that thought, where we are is the United States has been the world's policeman. We were in the first half of the 20th century. We were in Vietnam. We were again in Panama. And then we were again in Iraq during the Persian Gulf War. And then we were again in 2000s, you know, during the Bush administration, Bush 2. I think what Barack Obama realizes and is trying to accomplish is if we don't break this bad habit now, if we don't detox the world out of the idea that America is always going to, you know, ultimately send in 50,000 of our kids to get 5,000 of them killed and another 25,000 of them maimed for life so their kids can be stupping, you know, princesses and flying around the world in private jets. And I'm being a little bit racist here, but I'm sorry. But if we don't break that cycle now, it's going to continue for the rest or the certainly the first half of this century. And I think this is a full-scale, large poker game where Barack Obama is sitting across the table from all these other nations, and they are waiting for us to blink. They are waiting for us to just go all in with our chips. And if he does that, we're going to lose because we're going to always be the ones. No one's ever going to step up. And I think this is the game he's playing. He is holding back as long as is humanly possible, literally as long as is humanly possible, because we can defeat ISIS with our military. There's no doubt in my mind, and I don't think too many people disagree with that. We can defeat them in a military fashion. We may not be able to do away with terrorism all over the world, but we can drive them back into Syria. The problem is, if we do it with U.S. men, we're going to be, you know, in that area of the world for the next 50 years with 10 to 20,000 troop presence. And anytime something, you know, comes up someplace else, Yemen, you know, Africa, you name it, it's going to be, let's wait for the U.S. to send in troops. I think that's what he's doing. I think it's a high stakes game. And again, I think he's handling it as best as any president could. There, I'm off my soapbox.
Sorry, I'm sorry. For a minute there, I thought I saw a Ford Model T go through. I thought we were 1938 all over again.
Okay, set me straight.
I'm just curious as, you know, how many Syrians and how many French now have to die for the president to make his point. We have tens of thousands dead in Syria. We have thousands more dying in Libya, where Daesh is now establishing a mark. We have 140 dead in France because Paris is taking the fight to Daesh and Al-Qaeda in Mali and in other parts of the world. You know, how many of them have to die before America says, yeah, okay, fine. We really are part of the world community and we need to kick in.
No, argument doesn't work at all. That argument doesn't work at all because we now have more Americans dead from handguns than automobile accidents. So when are we going to fix that? When, you know, like, it's not our job. It is not our job to do that. It is maybe our job moving forward to convince the rest of the world that they have a greater responsibility militarily. It is our job to maybe move Muslim nations into getting the evil out of their religion. It is maybe, you know, it is. I don't think it's fair. I don't think it's accurate to say that it didn't work and now it's our job again, because it will always be our job and it shouldn't be.
Yeah,
that's my point. It
will always be our job. Because we are the most powerful nation on earth, and because we're the only ones who actually are willing to do it. And on some level, you know, it's God forgive me, I'm quoting a comic. With great power comes great responsibility. And this is an example. The notion that we can just sit back and go, you know, we're going to show the rest of the world we won't intervene in everything, and that they're going to have to take care of this ourselves. That's a hell of a lesson to teach somebody who we asked to help us in 2006 and 2007, and who are now getting mowed down by Daesh, by the way, most of whom are actually holdovers from Saddam Hussein's regime, the Ba'athists who went underground and then took this group over. And then we say, nope, we are going to show you that you need to fend for yourselves. After we asked them to help us in 2006 and 2007, How dare we? How goddamn dare we?
I'm sorry, I'm not buying into that.
Now, I think until we also apply that to gun control, I think that argument doesn't work. I think there are other arguments that may work better, but, you know, now more people have died. Well, it's a whole, but we can't apply it to just one thing. It has to be across the board, I think.
Alan, what do you think?
I think I just died of boredom.
No, you didn't. Come on.
I don't have anything to add.
Really? Okay. Okay. Well, you know, I think I don't want to speak for you, DJ. I mean, excuse me, Jonah, but I think we're sort of on the same side on this, or at least of the same opinion. And hence the divide. And I think this is the divide.
Well, here's the divide. The divide is this. The two sides are playing with two different decks of facts, and they won't. They're like, when you've got two sets of facts, you'll have two sides at all times, and they won't be able to come together. I mean, if we all agreed on one thing or another, we might be able to have a talk about it. But the bottom line is, the right and the left, they don't even share the same facts. So that's, people talk about why we're so divided. That's why we're so divided. I mean, at this point, a good majority of the right says that climate change doesn't exist, and the majority of the left says climate change is not only exists but is man-made and is going to be tragic. And at this point, there's two sets of facts there. How can you possibly come together when there's two sets of facts like that? What are the two sets of facts?
Hang on.
Okay.
To the extent that there are arguments about climate change, there are three parts. One is the issue of the temperature data, which we found out actually in the U.S. at least is driven by temperature data reporting stations, that two-thirds of which are actually out of compliance.
Okay, you guys are going to go deep again. That's totally cool. But what I'm saying is, I don't mean that there's actually two sets of facts. I'm saying that each side believes their facts are correct, and the facts that the other side is playing with are incorrect. You know what I'm talking about. When I say two sets of facts, that's what I'm talking about.
Okay. My apologies, Alan. I now have a better understanding of what you mean. I think in this case, though, getting back to our discussion, Lindsey Graham is about the only person who would probably agree with anything remotely compared to what I just admittedly spewed over the last 10 or 15 minutes. Most Republicans have moved away from this, as I have repeatedly joked, and I knew it was going to happen, and it has happened. I'm one of the last six people on the planet who thinks the deposing of Saddam Hussein was a good idea. I understand that this would happen, and it has happened. That's fine. Lindsey Graham apparently was one of those six people. I do think, getting back to the discussion, Rubio will probably be the first one to say there should be some ground contingent. A couple of others may follow him: Bush, Kasich, Christie. Cruz will probably be the one who says, no, we can pound them from the air. Rand Paul will say, no, we can't handle them at all. And Donald Trump will say whatever the heck will get him
He'll
on
say
the front
something
pages
classy.
For 3 weeks.
He'll say something classy. And whatever it is he says, it'll be the best, too.
So I think, you know, the Democrats also had a debate. And I kind of, yeah, I know. I even watched it. But I think, mentioning climate change, I think O'Malley had the best soundbite on this because it didn't come up at all in the Republican debate. And O'Malley just said, you know, to paraphrase him, whether it's real or not, why not take advantage of this and just boost the economy by getting, you know, just more investment into alternative energy sources? Because they're not there yet, and we can't run our country or a state on alternative energy right now, but why not turn a disadvantage into an advantage? So, I don't know. I agree with him on that. See, me and Lindsey Graham and Rand Paul and Martin O'Malley are in this. We're forming a coalition.
The problem that O'Malley has when he says something like that is that he is confusing wise economic investments with putting money into stuff that I like, and those aren't the same thing. And we all fall for it because we all look at the things we like and go, oh, that obviously must be better for the economy. I can go on about defense spending for 10 or 15 minutes, and the three of you will look at me and go, do you really think that, or you just like defense spending? And I can't give you an answer because I know me. So, you know, the assumption that alternative energy is the best investment is not something that is universal. In fact, a lot of people, even within the global warming movement would tell you, you know, what we really need is nuclear energy. But they don't want to be too loud about it because it'll split the movement in half. Bill McKibben admitted that apparently in an interview to the Daily Caller.
I live in a town that Dow Chemical, Dow Corning, headquartered here, and we took a bunch of money to build a battery plant. It's an alternative fuel kind of hydrogen battery, all that stuff, and it's failing miserably. They shuttered it. So I mean, economic growth. Well, money was spent. I mean, it doesn't mean that it was well spent, but it was spent. You know, what do you do? I think your point's well taken, because the thing about it is every politician is going to feel like the stuff that they think money should be spent on is what's going to be good for the economy. And I think, unfortunately, it's hard to tell until it's there. You know.
And here's the thing. And very few people are actually willing to push it for a whole host of reasons politically. If you want carbon consumption reduced, then tax it. Don't waste our time with emissions trading schemes and creating false assets that Wall Street can make billions of dollars off of, which is essentially what they've done with the emissions trading scheme. Don't crumb up with 20th century regulatory schemes like the president has done. Just tax the thing. And if that's a problem, if you don't like tax increases, Lord knows I don't, fine, then cut taxes somewhere else to match it. British Columbia did that in 2008. They said, we're instituting a carbon tax, and we're going to cut income and corporate income taxes to match it. They've had fuel consumption go down. Their economy has not suffered. In theory, it should work for everybody. The left gets reduction in carbons. The right gets no tax increases and government doesn't get larger. But nobody pushes it. I don't know why.
It's a good question.
Me neither.
So what'd you guys think of the Democrat debate? Anything jump out at you?
Well, first of all, I thought all three of them did very well. I thought it was a very close debate. I don't know that anyone came out a winner. I thought Sanders comported himself very well. Obviously, I think Hillary Clinton is sharp, but she had a couple of, moments where I think she was straining to connect the dots. I think, we know who these people are now. I think that Democrats just have to sit down and decide which one of them they think is going to be the better candidate in the fall.
Okay, Kevin, you and I, before the show started, were talking about this. I don't think there's a chance that Bernie can even touch Hillary, and you think that there is. So I think we should talk about that.
I second what Alan says, but go ahead, Kevin. You're the Democrat.
Okay.
Kevin has
arguments, but
I think there's a chance too. I think there's a
okay. Let's hear it. I want to hear it.
But do you want to go first, Jonah?
Well, I've said it before, but I think that Hillary Clinton can kill herself. she can destroy her own campaign. Like she's done this off and on throughout her political life. She's been her own worst enemy. And I think that there's a combination, there's a perfect storm of her saying dumb things, of some new scandal, Bernie Sanders having a good week at the right time. I think that there is a possibility of 10 things happening that takes her down. I think that's slim, but I think it is possible because she does. The more I watch her, the less I like her. And my high point for her was after the Benghazi hearings. When I watched the summaries of that and I read a lot of the articles and I thought they should just shut up and leave her alone. And anytime a bunch of guys jump at a woman and start swinging their dicks around, I generally try to support the woman. And that's what I felt happened there. And now I feel like, oh, she's also an asshole. I forgot. And that's where I am now.
Unless, God, this is going to sound terrible, but unless one of those 10 things is Bernie Sanders suddenly discovering that he has African American ancestry,
oh God,
Hillary's going to be just fine. No, I'm serious. Hillary in 2008, and I don't, I just want to be careful. Well, I've already stepped in it, so what the hell? In 2008, Hillary accidentally ran against history. She didn't mean to. But it happened in front of her.
Yes,
and I would say it was just she ran against the wrong history, because it could have gone the other way. But Anyhow,
well,
go,
okay, that
going.
Could that could very well be. I see your point. I see your point. Mm-hmm. She's not running against history. She's running against Bernie Sanders. So unless Bernie Sanders can either become the second African-American president or the first potential Hispanic-American president.
Transgender. Hillary will be fine. I say transgendered. There's still a chance.
So
long as the senator from Vermont does not become Bernadette Sanders, Hillary is just fine.
Hillary
has trouble running against running against the onrush of history. She will not have trouble running against the onrush of Bernie Sanders.
She was really good in the debate. She was really good in the debate. So she doesn't have to be. She doesn't even, you know, she only has to just be not really bad,
right,
don't you think?
Right.
I mean, like, she was very good.
She's got the title. She just has to fight him to a draw.
She's like the Detroit Lions. Except she's going to win. That's the difference between she and the Detroit Lions. But the bottom line is, the only way that she's going to lose is if she gives it away. And I think she's not going to.
So let me jump in with my analysis for whatever it's worth. And I will preface this by saying this could just be me being a nervous Nelly, because obviously, as I say many times, and I want to be, candor, I'm for Hillary Clinton. So here's my concern. As we all remember, Barack Obama won Iowa in somewhat of a surprise in 2008. He was leading in New Hampshire, which was about, I think, 7 or 9 days later. And then in the last day or two, something happened in New Hampshire, and all of a sudden, Hillary Clinton upsets him in New Hampshire. And, you know, there's a lot of theories about why that happened, but high among them is the idea that New Hampshire voters looked at Iowa and said, you know what? If we vote for this guy again, that seals it. And we're not ready to call off this race yet. We're not ready to give him the nomination after just two primaries. I think that that was part of the equation in 2008. Now cut to 2016. If, you know, Bernie Sanders is doing very well in New Hampshire, but I think everybody kind of knows, people who are somewhat sophisticated realize that if Hillary Clinton wins Iowa, even if Sanders wins New Hampshire, she's probably going to walk to the nomination after that. So the one possible, you know, chink in her armor may be if Iowa voters say to themselves, you know what, we're not ready to give this to her yet with our votes. And if enough people vote for Sanders and he wins Iowa, or he comes in a close second, it's, you know, 48 to 45, and then, you know, Martin O'Malley picks up the rest. And then Sanders goes in and has a strong first place showing in New Hampshire, we're off and running. Now, I'm not saying that Hillary Clinton is going to, you know, crumble after that. I'm saying we're in a race, and at that point, a lot of things can happen.
I would like to say to counter that, I actually took a quick look at the 2008 Iowa figures, and here's something that we forget. Yes, Barack Obama beat Hillary Clinton in Iowa. I got my states wrong. But so did John
so
Edwards.
So did John Edwards.
Hillary came in third in Iowa. There is no scenario under which she comes third in Iowa this time. In fact, I'm fairly certain that she wins Iowa, because the Iowans who will go in there and will say, and who will have that risk, you know, some of them may say, you know, do we really want to hand it to her just yet? Do we not? They'll have New Hampshire out there, and they'll say, well, you know, New Hampshire never listens to us anyway, so we can go ahead and do what we want, and then we'll let New Hampshire be the contrarian this time. So I don't think Bernie can come close enough in Iowa to do what he needs to do in South Carolina and Nevada and Florida, because that's South Carolina was where Obama frankly recovered from his New Hampshire loss.
Right.
That's where he got started going again. He was able to stop the notion that Clinton was inevitable.
And she will too.
And you're right. And that's, but there is no way that Bernie can replicate that in South Carolina. There's absolutely no way at all. He's the wrong kind of Democrat for that state. And I think that pretty much seals it, no matter what Iowa and New Hampshire do.
Okay. Well, again, and we'll know in 6 weeks. I'm not speaking as, you know, Mr. Know-it-all, although I know I sound like that. I'm just speaking as a nervous Nelly Democrat who supports Hillary Clinton. I just fear that there's going to be a last moment surge in his favor and he does better than expected in Iowa. He beats expectations, as they say, and that could change the equation. If she wins Iowa, I don't care what happens in New Hampshire. He could beat her by 30 to 40 points, and she still wins the nomination.
Right. All right, you guys. Yeah, go ahead. Finish up.
No, I'm done.
All right, before we go, I want you guys to each make a wild guess as to who the next Republican to drop out is, because I'm hoping that within the next 2 weeks, like 8 of them drop out or something like that. So who's the next one out?
Rand Paul or Mike Huckabee?
I think, you know, we've talked about this before, but I think after Iowa, it'll be Santorum or Huckabee, I think.
It'll be a flood after Iowa.
I think it will be too.
I am actually going to stick my neck way, way out and take a flyer, because I don't know if any of them will before Iowa. So what the hell? Jeb Bush.
I'm saying Ben Carson, because you know what? That dude's dropping like a lead balloon.
Yeah, he's lost a lot.
He has, and it's been ugly, and he had no showing in the debate that I could see. So,
yeah.
But our guesses are all as good as anyone else's, of course, but it's kind of fun to speculate. I do hope after Iowa that it clears, because then we could actually have a little bit more, I don't know. Then I think you're going to see Trump's true colors, but all right.
You think Christie is third? You think he's coming in second to New Hampshire?
I think he comes in third to New Hampshire.
I think he's at least a third. I think he might be second. I think
he could be the surprise of the year. And I've said this before. I wouldn't be surprised if it became a Trump Christie race.
He's shown up well enough in the debates recently that I wouldn't put it past him either. So like I said, I think that was a three or four person debate last week. But
Christie needs New Hampshire more than the other three do.
Yeah,
he needs to be strong out of New Hampshire in order for this to work. He's essentially doing the McCain playbook, win in New Hampshire and everything else will fall to you.
Yeah. Right.
We'll see what happens.
All right, you guys, a little bit more heated debate tonight. It was kind of interesting. So let's wrap it up and we will talk to you again next week.
All right. Next week then.